I don't see any reason to engage in sterile debates about whether 1914 and World War I usher in a new period. It's well established. It would be fairly silly to challenge it. But it's not a period that stands in isolation from what went before. And this raises challenge number two, a little more specific. Although it's a new period, there is obviously carryover from what happened in the long 19th century, as well as even earlier. For example, the influence of the West continued to be very strong on into the 21st century, particularly perhaps in the area of culture, to some extent in terms of political institutions, and certainly still in world economics and military power. The world economy also persisted in some ways. This is a theme we're going to talk about more specifically next time. It really should be folded into the periodization discussion, but it's another continuity. And if we argue, as we briefly did, that one can trace the limited beginnings of modernization in the latter part of the long 19th century, clearly modernization blossoms further, with all the cautions attached to the concept, in the contemporary period. So, novelty, yes, I think it's valid to say new period, but the spillover is unsurprising and significant. The two key issues, however, in dealing with the contemporary period in world history that we didn't have in previous periods, the two key issues involve the recency and complexity of developments over the past century and the simple fact that we don't know the end of the story. We can talk about change away from long 19th century patterns, and we'll do that quite concretely in our discussion here. But we can't always, indeed, we can't usually say, well, the old patterns have shifted, and now the new patterns are well established. They aren't. And we can have questions, we can see change, we can't make final determinations, usually, of new directions. And that's just part of the territory. The busyness of the past century partly, of course, reflects our own involvement in it. Some of us lived through a fair part of it. And it also reflects the extent to which we are traditionally and properly filled with stories about World War I, about World War II, the Depression, some of the developments since World War II, etc. It's hard to place this in perspective. It's hard to sort out. And making this a little bit more specific, the 20th, early 21st centuries themselves, since 1914, are conventionally divided into three chunks. There is 1914 to 1945, dominated by two world wars, the Depression, the clear disarray of Western society, some stirrings in other societies, the force of new revolutions, particularly in the Soviet Union. This is period number one. Period number two, 1945 to around 1990, involves obviously the overarching system of the Cold War, which, although I think less important than it seemed at the time, obviously provides an alternative to the main frame of reference that applied to the World War and interwar period. And then the Soviet Union collapses, the Cold War is officially over, and one enters the third phase of the contemporary era, marked perhaps by the emergence of the United States as, quote, the world's only superpower, possibly by the early 21st century, with some new questions about whether even that role was going to last all that long. I think the best way to sort out this internal periodization, because frankly, 30-year chunks are just too short for world history. They would magnify details in the contemporary experience at the expense of the big picture. I think the best way to sort out these intermediate chunks is to see World War I as opening a new series of questions about the Western role in the world, and particularly West European role, which led to a clear decline of Western Europe in world affairs, marked after World War II, which then opened a transitional framework in which, at least officially, the Soviet Union and its allies and the U.S. and its allies disputed world dominance. That transitional system failed, much like other earlier transitional systems. For example, the Great Chinese Voyages at the end of the post-classical period. Other transitional systems have been sketched and failed. The Cold War was a first statement of what to do about the shifting world power balance. It didn't last. And now, in the third phase of the contemporary era, we're involved in some more open-ended questions about what the new power structure will be. And we'll return to this in just a moment. One final preliminary. And the preliminaries are, again, a little more detailed than usual, because this really is a tough assignment, an intriguing one, but tough. We are accustomed to hearing that the pace of change has sped up in the modern world, and maybe it has. But it's really important to remember that if this is a new and major period in world history, opening up with World War I, it's still very novel. Its advent is still very recent. So it's not totally surprising that some of the details have yet to be worked out. Some of the new themes have yet to be fully established. Change may well speed up, but we don't want to exaggerate that process. It takes a while for any world history period to sort itself out. And I think that's clearly involved here. All right. What are the new themes? I want to begin by sketching a few possibilities, most of which yield this nagging question, well, what's the actual novelty here? What's the definite new pattern? Then talk about the clearest way in which the long 19th century stops predominating, and then turn more positively to the basic themes that I think are really definitional for this contemporary era. Socially, if you look at the world in 1900 or even 1914, the dominant social class in most societies, a couple of exceptions to be sure, including the United States, the dominant social class in most societies was still the landed aristocracy, the class that had loomed so large in the history of agricultural civilizations for many centuries. By the early 21st century, while landed aristocrats still played some role in some cases, the aristocracy is really pretty well gone, a huge change in the fabric of world social structure. And it had been replaced, and here I think we can see what came next. It had been replaced by a new kind of middle class, upper business professional class, sometimes mixing in government bureaucrats, that thought of the world more in industrial than in agricultural terms, more in urban terms than in rural, more in managerial structures than in terms of private land ownership, a really significant shift. This is one way to say this is a new period, and in this case, we can even put a face on the next pattern. Something of the same thing applies to politics, but here with later certainty about what the new pattern is. Striking fact. If you look at the world's major political regimes in 1900 or even 1910, they were predominantly monarchies or empires. Again, some interesting exceptions, but predominantly in most parts of the world. If you look at the dominant political regimes of the early 21st century, these systems are largely gone. A huge change, not just compared to the long 19th century, but compared to the longer history of agricultural societies in the world. What the alternatives were, however, was less clearly established. Democracies, in some instances, perhaps a growing number of instances, replaced monarchies and empires. But other candidates, still successful in the early 21st century, included authoritarian regimes, communist systems. It's clear that the old political systems had stopped working with very few exceptions. Less clear whether there would be a single agreed-upon alternative that would take their place. Women's affairs, and again we'll talk more extensively about this in a later discussion, women's affairs or gender relationships also seem to enter a clear new period in this contemporary world history era. Older systems of patriarchy began to be modified by efforts to give women the vote, improve their educational levels, provide them some new legal rights. Even by the later 20th century, even reduce average birth rates in almost every region of the world, though at different rates. On the other hand, it was not clear exactly how you'd define the gender system that would replace the old system. It wasn't yet, at least, clearly egalitarian. It hadn't clearly worked out on a global basis what women's economic role should be. It hadn't clearly worked out some issues of ongoing or renewed male violence against women. We can see change. It's valid to see the contemporary period partly defined by significant shifts and new questions about gender relations. But defining the new is not as easy as suggesting that the old was beginning to disappear. And finally, this is very much the case, and again we'll have an explicit discussion of this, very much the case when one turns to culture. The contemporary period of world history sees a clear set of new challenges to certain kinds of older cultural beliefs. Challenges coming from communism, from a greater mass appeal of nationalism, and from consumerism and science, values that were emphasized in places like the West and Japan. But first of all, these new cultural options didn't entirely agree with each other. And second of all, quite clearly, they had not, by the early 21st century, clearly succeeded in displacing the old, most notably, the hold of world religions. The cultural map of this contemporary period of world history was exceedingly complicated, and one can't even say for sure that the older patterns that had prevailed previously had been definitively vanquished. Point one, then, in addition to the preliminaries on the complexities of the period itself. Point one, it's possible, certainly in social structure, almost certainly in political regimes, fairly extensively in gender relationships, it's possible very clearly to see that something new began to go on in the world beginning fairly early in the 20th century. Less clear, particularly aside from the replacement of the old upper class socially, less clear how the world would come to define what the alternative system would turn out to be, or whether there would in fact be a clear decision about this at all. And in the cultural realm, lots of change, lots of effervescence, lots of real conversions to new patterns of belief, but no overall clarity at all as to what was going to become core, become central in global cultures. And possibly culture will remain, at least for a long time, one of those areas, and this isn't a new phenomenon in world history either, where you simply have to say you can't define the period in this category. You have to look on a case-by-case basis, despite the presence of some overarching trends and questions. The clearest way to begin a more coherent definition of this new period in world history, and particularly the clearest reason to begin essentially with World War I, involves the shift away from several of the dominant patterns of the long 19th century and even to some extent aspects of the early modern period. Clearest here in turn, remember we're going to talk about the world economy next time, clearest here in turn is the relative decline of the West. This, I have to say, is somewhat controversial. Sometimes people get upset about this, particularly if the United States is included in the West. So I want to be clear. Relative decline, first of all, does not necessarily mean absolute decline. Many people worried during the period between the world wars, many people worried that the West was really beginning to fade, as Rome had faded earlier, or other analogies of this sort. The revival of Western Europe, the success of the United States after World War II, may well have put these fears permanently to rest. We don't yet know, obviously, the future. There are continued concerns that 50 years hence, Western Europe will simply be less significant than it is today, and there may even be some questions about the United States' staying power. But to date, this century has not seen, from an internal standpoint, this century has not seen a clear decline in Western affairs. And indeed, Western Europe has been remarkable in post-World War II particularly, in its ability to absorb loss of power, particularly loss of colonies, without denting basic economic, political, and cultural dynamism and capacity to innovate. We're also not arguing that the West has somehow declined relatively so much that it's still not a, and perhaps the, major player in world power politics. But I think the evidence here is compelling, and again, I think it begins to show itself in World War I. World Wars I and II, in many senses, can be seen, apart from their global dimensions, which are also important, as a giant internal civil war within the West, in which the West accelerated its inability to maintain its power position in the world because of the amount of damage different Western societies inflicted on each other in not just one, but two major conflicts. Economic damage, huge population losses, erosion of the capacity to rule other parts of the world, etc. The measurements of relative decline that are particularly important, I think, are twofold, although, again, we'll have to talk about a world economy angle here next time as well. First of all, military. Of course, in the early 21st century, the West, particularly if the U.S. is included, still possessed the greatest amount of military power in the world as a whole, the U.S. way ahead of the whole pack. But the capacity of the West, the capacity that was so obvious in so many parts of the world during the long 19th century, the capacity of the West to move almost at will militarily, clearly had stopped by the second half of the 20th century. Several factors obviously contributed to this, including the extent to which Western countries themselves, particularly in Europe, began to be less willing to invest quite as heavily in military activities to maintain fully cutting-edge military technologies. First, beyond this, several other parts of the world began to emphasize new military tactics that could stalemate the West's advantage in conventional armament. The big development here, it wasn't new, but it became more important. The big development here was the success of guerrilla warfare in places like Vietnam. But also, as it turns out, if you look at Algeria and then more recently Iraq, the capacity of resistance elements in urban settings also successfully to resist the overwhelming superiority of Western armaments. The West's military advantage, uncontested still, could obviously be almost nullified by the emphasis on these renewed strategies. Second, as individual countries, even middle-sized countries outside the West, gained independence and gained some measure of growing economic capacity, one of the things they did with these two developments was to invest in increasingly significant military force, which meant that the capacity of small numbers of Western troops easily to move into a country like Iraq was actually gone. The West, of course, could still defeat middle-sized countries, but it took a lot more planning. It took a lot more economic commitment, like the huge buildup before the Gulf War of the early 1990s. And obviously, as Iraq would later demonstrate, even that kind of military success, though possible in one sense, didn't really assure victory. So, point one. From the 15th century onward, on the whole, the West had been gaining increasing military advantage over other societies, first on the seas, then in the long 19th century on land as well. The contemporary period of world history saw this trend interrupted, not eliminated yet, but interrupted, and the West's military action in the wider world became more complicated and more contested. Related to this was the second key development: the West's capacity to control most of the rest of the world directly through colonies and colonial administrations clearly ended in the contemporary period of world history, which means that one of the really key developments beginning between the wars, and again, World War I is a valid starting point, and accelerating after World War II, one of the key developments in setting the framework for this new period in world history was the movement of decolonization. The West's willingness or inability to resist the formation of independent nations where colonies or significant Western enclaves had previously predominated. Now, of course, Western political and economic influence could survive decolonization in some cases, but the political map of the world became not just more detailed in terms of the huge increase in the number of independent nations, but more complicated in the sense of a much reduced capacity of any single civilization or society to dominate the world politically. Relative military decline, clear political decline, some new competition in the economic sphere, which again we'll detail in a fuller sense in our next session. These developments marked a clear termination of one of the dominant themes of the long 19th century, setting the stage, obviously, for other themes to take their place. What's the final outcome? Again, I have to come back to uncertainty. Some people argue that the relative decline of the West will ultimately yield predominance of another civilization, and probably the most common candidate is East Asia. But although we've had many world history periods, the post-classical, the long 19th century, in which one civilization really did wield a power position much greater than others, there's no inherent reason for this to be the next pattern. Maybe there will be greater balance among several sectors in the world, either harmoniously, relatively speaking, or amid great tension. Again, we don't know the end of the story. All we know is that the story is largely new. Several new themes do begin, I think, to gain ascendancy in this contemporary period of world history. Themes that were only sketched, hinted at, or prepared in the long 19th century previously. A couple of candidates need to be mentioned, and then I want to turn to what seem to me to be the two crucial ones. First of all, obviously, some centuries hence, people may look back at the contemporary period of world history and say, ah, the fundamental innovation in this period was the beginning of humankind's conquest of outer space. And I'm perfectly willing, hoping that our societies last long enough for this to be possible, I'm perfectly willing for this verdict to be rendered. But in the early 21st century, although space exploration has occurred, it has not yet had sufficiently deep impact on the nature of human life or the main patterns of global societies for me to do more than list the possibility for a future retrospective. A more serious candidate is the altered nature of war in the 20th century and the altered nature of military technology. The two world wars were what some observers have described as total war. That is, they mobilized all the major resources of key combatants, not just armies and navies, but the economy harnessed to the war effort, propaganda, tying civilians into the emotional qualities of war. And there was a third total war in the later 20th century, the several years conflict between Iran and Iraq. Add to this, obviously, the fact that World War II ushered in a new military technology that could, as far as anyone knows, bring human life and perhaps life in general to an end in the world, nuclear military capacity. And you have a possible formula, one of the key new themes of the contemporary era in world history, clearly different from patterns previously, involved heightened organizational capacity in war, the fact that all resources could be bent to the conflict, and societies insist on total surrender as a result of this investment, plus the new and devastating and fearsome new technology, and maybe this has reshaped world affairs more generally. I'm not, frankly, absolutely sure. Many wars continue to be conducted at slightly less awesome rates. World diplomacy has not been entirely reshaped by the nuclear threat. So put this down as a possible, and maybe with an asterisk, we hope this will not become one of the defining characteristics of the New World History period. The two that I think are, again, in addition to the negative, the relative decline of the West, the two themes that I do think deserve clear emphasis are, first of all, massive global population increase. The 20th century saw a tripling of world populations from about 2 billion to over 6 billion, and the process would clearly continue at least into the middle of the 21st century. At that point, declining birth rates may usher in a new demographic regime, among other things featuring the growing aging of societies, and maybe all bets will be off. But for the moment, this huge surge in global populations is a noteworthy phenomenon in its own right. Never before had world populations increased so rapidly in such a short span of time. And it carries over into a number of other definable features that begin to reshape the world, although there had been a couple of hints in the latter stages of the long 19th century. For example, world population explosion clearly helps encourage new patterns of immigration. And instead of immigration largely consisting of movements of peoples to societies that were, broadly speaking, culturally somewhat similar to points of origin, immigration, particularly by the later 20th century, though there were hints even in the 1920s and 30s, immigration now increasingly consists of peoples moving from Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia, to particularly Western societies, not just the U.S. now, but Western Europe, as well as, of course, Canada, Australia, and to a limited extent, even to Japan. Movements that bring people from much different cultural backgrounds together, that constitute a much more interesting mix and possibly a more challenging and tenser mix than most migration patterns had previously involved. So, population explosion vital in itself, leading to new types of immigration patterns and new challenges to many societies in the process. Population explosion also places unprecedented stress on global environments. Global environmental change, and I'm not merely trying to be politically correct here, global environmental change is an inescapable facet of developments, certainly by the later 20th century, and while there are several components, the population explosion, the sheer multiplication of human wastes, becomes an inescapable part of this process. That's theme one. Defining theme number two, probably more predictable, involves the steady, not constant, but recurrent acceleration of communications and transportation technologies that speed up contacts around the world, that speed up the capacity of people to move quickly in contact with other people, that set a, I think, revolutionary new technological framework for relationships among major societies. Key developments obviously include radio, sometimes linked by undersea cable, the emergence of satellite communications, the emergence in 1990 of the Internet, air travel. The list is long and, frankly, fairly familiar. But the main point is not the list of specific technologies, but the extent to which they pose unprecedented new opportunities and, in some ways, unprecedented threats and challenges to the identities of individual societies. The acceleration of movement of ideas, goods, and peoples, what sometimes gets referred to as globalization, which we will turn to in the very final discussion in this sequence. This, it seems to me, is an indisputable mark of the new period in world history. Now, we don't fully know how this one will work out either. Again, we can see the new forces. We can't fully determine what kind of world they're going to shape because we're only a century in to the new developments. We'll turn next time, as I suggested, to changes in the world economy, where unexpectedly, I think, we'll find some echoes of the themes we've been talking about today. Significant new change, not full certainty about